Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a bit later in today's show, Director of Radio Ann Alquist talks with Brian Bull about President Biden's commutation of Leonard Peltier's life sentence after being convicted of killing two FBI agents. And we begin Main Street today with Dr. Harish Ahuja, a hematologist and oncologist with Essentia Health. It's my pleasure to have you with us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
The topic today is the United States Surgeon General came out and urged warning labels on alcoholic beverages, Doctor, and he essentially has told us one is too many. And we want to get into all of that today. And of course, his link was is that it really increases cancer risk. Does the cancer risk, in your view, increase with any amount of alcohol, or is there a safe threshold?
Yeah, the simple and short answer is there is no safe threshold. There is no safe threshold below which there is no risk. It is estimated that in the U.S. there are approximately 20,000 alcohol-related cancers diagnosed every year. And if you look at the breakdown or the spread of these cancers, of all these 20,000 alcohol-related cancers, 83% occurred in individuals who drank above the recommended drinks per day. But about 17%, roughly one in five that is, occurred in individuals that drank below that level. So clearly, this data suggests that there's no threshold below which there is no risk. Cancer can occur for a variety of reasons. Alcohol is just one of them. So you can get cancers, you know, which are non-alcohol related, but studies have shown that there's a relationship between the amount you drink and the duration you drink and the risk of cancer.
Did the Surgeon General's warning surprise you when he came out so forcefully?
So it didn't totally surprise me. It basically just reiterated what we've been reading all along about alcohol and the risks of cancer. This data has been evolving over the last 10, 15 years, and I guess that it was about time that not doing anything was not a good idea. I mean, we really needed to get the information out to the public. And
are there certain types of cancers that have a stronger tie to alcohol?
Yeah, there are at least seven different types of cancers that are definitely linked to alcohol, but there may be more for which strong evidence or data is still being looked at. So the seven types of cancers that are alcohol related for sure are mouth cancer, larynx cancer, throat cancer, esophagus cancer, that's the food pipe, liver cancer, colorectal cancers, and breast cancers in females.
But we've all heard of studies. Some have said, hey, a drink a day is good for your heart. What should we be thinking about those things that we remember from back in the day?
Well, I think there's a need to relook at our guidelines and relook at what updates we need to make to our guidelines. Clearly, data has evolved over the last few years that suggests that any form of drinking, however little, is detrimental to your health from a cancer standpoint. There could be some benefits. For example, alcohol has been shown in very small amounts to reduce the risk of blood clots and strokes, but that data also is not validated. Mm-hmm. So I think if you look at that small benefit versus the excessive risks of alcohol intake, the math clearly tells you that the risks are far greater than the benefits.
Do we know how alcohol contributes to the development of cancer at the cellular level or molecular level for a dummy like me that doesn't understand all of the intense science?
Yeah, sure. It's actually quite interesting. So when one ingests alcohol, it goes into your stomach and then goes into the small intestine, from where it is absorbed into the blood, and then it's taken to the liver. So in the liver, there is an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, and the short form of which is ADH. So this alcohol dehydrogenase, and the levels in individuals vary. You know, you can have a high level, I could have a low level, and so on and so forth. So the amount of the enzyme matters in terms of how much it metabolizes the alcohol. So alcohol via this enzyme and through two or three other enzymes is ultimately converted into acetaldehyde in the body. Now, acetaldehyde is a genotoxin. That means it can bind to DNA, creating DNA aldehyde adducts, which increase the risk of mutations in the DNA of an individual. And so if those mutations occur in genes that, say, for example, control cell growth or proliferation, you can imagine how that process could be thrown off track, and that may ultimately result in cancer. So that's just one of the mechanisms, but there are others. For example, in females, we know that alcohol increases estradiol or estrogen levels in the blood, and we know that estrogen or estradiol is a risk factor for breast cancer in women. There are other ways, I think, that it can cause cancer. Another postulated mechanism is that alcohol can act as a solvent for other carcinogens. So, for example, if you smoke and drink at the same time, the carcinogens in tobacco can be dissolved in alcohol. Alcohol also changes the cellular structure of the cells in the mouth. So along with the change in the cellular structure and the carcinogens dissolving in the alcohol, you can imagine how that can easily lead to carcinogenesis in the oral cavity.
Is all alcohol the same? In other words, is beer different from wine, different from spirits relative to risk?
So you have to understand, or you have to know what the amount of alcohol in each of these drinks is. So if you take a can of beer, you know, that contains about 14 grams of alcohol. Basically, a glass of wine, which is roughly 5 ounces, will also contain the same amount. If you take hard liquor, for example, just an ounce and a half will contain about 14 grams of alcohol. So each of these drinks has enough alcohol in them, the way we currently consume them, that there shouldn't be any difference in the cancer risk. And we see that from studies.
Is it the case that people that have one drink a week are less likely, does the data show, than someone who has a drink every day versus somebody who has two or three drinks a day?
Yeah, absolutely. According to current medical research, like I said, no amount is safe. And let me give you an example about this relationship between the amount of alcohol consumed and the risk of cancer. So I have actually looked up some studies, and there was a recent study that was a pooled analysis of like 26 different studies. And it was found that for oral cavity cancer or mouth cancer, the relative odds of developing cancer increased by 40% for those who consumed about a drink daily compared to those who did not or drank less than one drink a day.
40%,
and I'll explain to you what that, it is important to understand.
It seems substantial.
So I'm going to explain to you what the difference between, you have to understand what a relative risk is and what an absolute risk is, and I'll come to that in just a minute. But just to kind of give you an idea of the different studies out there, there was another pooled analysis of like a million women and found that the relative risk of breast cancer increased by 10% for women who consumed one drink daily compared to those who did not drink. And a third global study also found an association between the higher the alcohol you took in, the higher the risk. Now, here's where the understanding about the relative and absolute risk comes in. And that's very important to understand. So the key words are relative and absolute. So when we talk about these risks, you have to understand that a large change in the relative risk could mean a very small risk in absolute terms. So let's explain. So let's say the risk of drowning in the US is about 1 in 1,000. And then a certain behavior, for example, increases that risk by, let's say, 100%. So that 100% is a big number But in absolute terms, 100% increase of one is two. So the number of individuals at risk because of this behavior of, say, let's say alcohol drinking and drowning, you increase the risk from one to two. So the absolute increase is one, but the relative increase is 100%. So you have to make sure that you understand those terms correctly. So when I say there's a 40% relative risk increase, it means 40% of what your baseline risk is. So if your risk is two for a certain event to occur, then 40% of that would be, you know, 0.4 times two would be, you know, 0.8.
Less than three, yeah.
So it'll be less than three in absolute terms, you know. So it's important to understand that. So while these risks may appear very large, the absolute risk is small.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Harish Ahuja, a hematologist and oncologist with Essentia Health. And we're discussing the new research that says even moderate drinking increases cancer risk, challenging perceptions of its health benefits. Are people genetically predisposed to cancer risks because of alcohol intake, do you think, doctor?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, again, the data is not conclusive, but we know that we all metabolize or activate alcohol into acetaldehyde at different levels in our body. So the enzyme that is important is the alcohol dehydrogenase, like I mentioned before. So if someone has a very high level of this enzyme, the amount of acetaldehyde that will be created is higher than someone whose enzyme level is low, where the acetaldehyde level will be lower. So there seems to be a relationship between the levels of these enzymes, and these are normal variations in individuals from one individual to the other. So the more the aldehyde that is produced, the higher the risk. And that is a theory out there, yeah.
Can we reduce alcohol consumption or quit entirely and also then reduce our cancer risk, or are we stuck with our history?
That's a good question. So in order to answer that question, we basically have to realize that there are genetic factors that predispose individuals to cancer. So let's talk about some of these common ones. So BRCA1 and BRCA2, or also known as BRCA1 and BRCA2, are genes that we all have. They help us repair damaged DNA. So if these genes are mutated, DNA cannot be repaired. And so that results in an increased cancer incidence. So women who have BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations tend to develop, you know, breast cancers at a very high frequency. Similarly, they tend to develop ovarian cancers at a high frequency. Men who have mutations in these genes develop prostate cancers at a high frequency. So obviously, when you drink and you have a genetic predisposition to cancer already, it sort of intuitively makes sense that you will increase your risk of these cancers that the genes predispose to. While it may sound intuitively reasonable, I don't think we have strong evidence to link the two. But studies definitely need to be done in this area. Similarly, there is another gene called mismatch repair gene, which is responsible for colorectal cancers. It's part of a syndrome that we call Lynch's syndrome. Again, you know, with the increased risk of colorectal cancers occurring in the setting of alcohol intake, and this gene already predisposing you to develop colorectal cancer, is there a multiplication or synergistic effect? I think those studies haven't been done, or the evidence is so far inconclusive.
Let me ask you this question. Do we know whether lifestyle factors, such as someone who's healthy and fit versus somebody who's overweight, they both drink a little bit? Is it worse for one than the other?
Again, the same answer applies to this as your previous question. I mean, we know that there are other lifestyle risk factors, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, eating processed meats in excess, drinking alcohol, smoking, you know, obesity, all of these lifestyle risk factors can increase cancers? And do we multiply the risk by taking alcohol and adding to the risk? We don't know that for sure at this point. And that's another area that there are gaps in our knowledge.
There are many people listening who like to have a beer with dinner. They like to go out and they like to have a drink. From your perspective, has your message now changed a little bit to those folks? What would you tell them?
So as a medical community, I think, we need to do more. You know, we basically know from our smoking studies that, smoking cessation has been a front and center risk-reducing strategy in our country. Once the advisories from the Surgeon General came out about smoking, you know, there has been a drastic decrease in the incidence of tobacco-related cancers. This, combined with the medical community taking on the challenge of empowering patients with the knowledge about alcohol and its risks, you know, having screening programs for alcohol out there, public education, you know, those are things that I think would make a big difference. Yeah. And so as a medical community, I think we need to emphasize and take a leaf out of what we did with tobacco. And we can already see the effects of that, the positive effects of that.
The playbook maybe has been written. Let me ask you this question in preparing for this interview. Germany has recommendations about alcohol consumption. Mm. Great Britain has recommendations about alcohol consumption in their National Health Service. So does Canada. So does the United States too, quite frankly. Mm. Now is the recommendation, don't.
Yeah, so if there was a nice survey done recently, and I forget who did it, but in that survey, they surveyed a large number of adults in the U.S., and they were trying to find out through that survey what did individuals perceive as risk for cancer. So when it came to radiation, about 90% knew that radiation is a risk factor. When it came to smoking, close to 85-90% knew that is a risk factor. But only 40-45% perceived alcohol as a risk factor, you know. So I think based on this, we definitely need to educate people out there. In fact, if you look at the global platform, the WHO actually has an initiative called the SAFER, S-A-F-E-R initiative, where it recommends that nations should increase excise taxes and minimal unit pricing to make it less affordable. There's also recommendations to limit the availability of alcohol by restricting where it can be sold. They also recommend regulating marketing and banning and limiting advertisement and sponsorship of alcohol drinks. And also they recommend raising the awareness as far as the public is concerned. So you're right, different countries have different recommendations, but there are at least, to my knowledge, 47 countries that require alcohol warning labels related to health and safety of alcohol. South Korea requires a cancer-specific warning on all its alcoholic drinks. And in come 2026, Ireland, the government in Ireland recently signed into law a new requirement to display a cancer warning label on all alcoholic beverages. And so this label will, and I quote, say the following: there is a direct link between alcohol and fatal cancer. So that label is going to be on all alcoholic drinks in Ireland come 2026.
The home of good Irish beer.
And it's ironical it's coming from Ireland. I mean, yeah.
I want to change gears just a little bit, and I want to let our listeners know that I warned you I would ask this question, but I think it's relevant. With recreational cannabis soon to be legal in a state right next door to us and is already legal in Montana, should some people look to switching to cannabis instead of using alcohol? Do we have recommendations or guidance about that? Or again, do we just not know enough to make a recommendation?
Well, we do know that cannabis can increase the risk of several cancers. I mean, again, there are gaps in our knowledge about the incidence and so on and so forth, but various cancers have been linked to cannabis use. Chief among them is testicular cancer in young males, you know. And so there's studies showing that there is a risk there. And there are other cancers as well, but again, I don't think we've had enough studies to just like we do with tobacco and alcohol. But I think over the next few years, that probably will be the next U.S. Surgeon General's warning, but data is lacking at this point.
Do you think the Surgeon General got it right relative to his alcohol warnings, Doctor?
If you ask me, yes. Obviously, there are people who would disagree, but I happen to believe yes. And again, you know, there are obviously people out there and advocates out there, especially from the alcohol industry, who claim that this is all epidemiological evidence and there are no randomized studies, which is the gold standard for anything to become a standard. But to do a randomized study is going to be horrendously difficult. You have to have thousands and thousands of people or individuals. One of them will drink alcohol, one will not, one will drink, one will not. And so, and at the end of several years, you will know for sure. But I think the evidence from epidemiological studies is strong enough that I think not doing anything at this point would be dangerous for the public itself.
We've enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Harish Ahuja, a hematologist and oncologist at Essentia Health. We've been talking about the United States Surgeon General's recent warnings, urging warning labels on alcoholic beverages to highlight their link to at least 7 cancers. Research shows even moderate drinking now increases cancer risk, challenging perceptions of its health benefits. Some interesting messaging, I think, will be following this, Doctor, from both sides now. I think that the beverage industry is going to counter this and continue to advertise a lot, and the medical community perhaps now
will take it more seriously and start, you know, educating people and screening for alcohol use and, you know, making this new finding or recent findings available to the public, then the public will have to make a decision.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
No worries. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming after the break, Director of Radio Ann Alquist visits with journalist Brian Bull about President Biden's commutation of the sentence of Leonard Peltier. That's after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Amidst the national news coverage of President Trump's second inauguration, a shockwave rippled through indigenous rights and justice organizations around the world when President Biden announced clemency for Leonard Peltier. The Turtle Lake Mountain Band of Ojibwe citizen was convicted in 1977 of killing 2 FBI agents after a 5-week trial in Fargo. Here's part of an interview he did in 1991 with Minnesota Public Radio.
Most important of all is that I am not guilty. I did not kill those agents. So therefore, I am in prison I'm illegally being held in prison.
You did shoot at them, though, did you not?
But that isn't concern. That isn't, that's not murder.
Mm-hmm.
Most important of all is that I am not guilty. I did not kill those agents. So therefore, I am in prison I'm illegally being held in prison.
You did shoot at them, though, did you not?
But that isn't concern. That isn't, that's not murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my co-defendants admitted it and were acquitted because of reasons of self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Crooks himself has made public statements that perhaps we did convict him for more than he's guilty of. Well, I'm sitting in prison now. They're claiming I was convicted of aiding and abetting. How many other prisoners in the United States of America are doing 2 life sentences for aiding and abetting?
Brian Bull has covered Native American issues at several outlets, including South Dakota Public Broadcasting, Wisconsin Public Radio, and National Native News. He interviewed Peltier when he was incarcerated at Leavenworth Prison, and our director of radio, Ann Alquist, caught up with him about the significance of granting clemency to Peltier.
Brian, where were you when you realized that President Biden had granted clemency to Leonard Peltier?
Interestingly enough, I was actually covering a Martin Luther King Jr. parade, march, and celebration happening in Eugene about the same time that news was breaking about the commutation of Peltier's sentence. A little bit of a serendipity there, in that a lot of the participants at that event, are always calling for more equal justice and fair ways of life and living for all people of color. And Martin Luther King Jr. himself had often spoken about the oppression and the genocide of Native people. So it was, as far as getting the news and learning about it, it was kind of a timely place to find myself.
Well, let's talk about the background of Leonard Peltier's case. It was right at the time you were born or before you were born in 1975. So give us some of the background about what was going on at the time. I'm thinking specifically about the American Indian movement. I'm thinking specifically about Pine Ridge.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people talk to me as if I was there or had been covering the story at length at the very beginning. And it's like, no, when the shootout happened in late June of 1975, I was actually 6 years old and probably living in Spokane, Washington at the time. And so, quite young, quite naive, and very far removed from the events of the time. The immediate incident that this whole case surrounds is a shootout that had occurred at a residence called the Jumping Bull Residence, no relation, on the Pine Ridge Reservation back in June 75. There were two FBI agents who I believe they're trying to serve an arrest warrant on someone completely outside Peltier. And they had followed a red and white vehicle, a pickup truck, onto the Jumping Bull Ranch. And there's a shootout between the two FBI agents, Jack Kohler and Ron Williams, against a number of individuals with the American Indian Movement. And from Peltier's account, there's two different accounts. One began with him being woken up by the sounds of gunfire. Another account said that he was working on a vehicle. And then another account, I think, even said that he had was just waking up to breakfast and was getting ready to serve, because there was a number of people there who were having a camp. And at that time, there were a lot of AIM members who were on site across the reservation as a way to kind of help safeguard people against both, I believe, federal agents, state, county police, and then also what were called the goons back in the 70s. There was a president of the Oglala Nation, Dick Wilson, who had formed a group called Guardians of the Oglala Nation, or as critics like to call them, the Goon Squad. And there were fierce skirmishes between goons and AIM members, with a lot of alleged violent murders happening all across Pine Ridge. And so there was a lot of tension that was already rampant in the South Dakota community, the Native community. This was also coming off of the 71-day standoff that AIM had with law enforcement that basically threw AIM into the national spotlight. And so there were a lot of people who were up in arms, and there were some very tense confrontations, not only between goons and AIM members, but varying groups of law enforcement. And so when the shootout erupted, there was a lot of confusion sometimes as to what exactly was happening. What the FBI says is that there was a call-in for help from Williams and Kohler, and that no other agent was within responding distance. I think even though someone had driven in at 90 miles per hour to get there, they were still too late to help back up the two agents. And so when they were found dead. I believe there was more than 100 bullet holes in the vehicles, and one of the vehicles had actually been towed away and stripped down. And so now the FBI was trying to determine through its own investigation and ballistics analysis who was responsible. And the long story short was is that there were, I believe, four individuals altogether who had been indicted in the murders of Agents Williams and Culler. Eventually, two individuals had charges dismissed. A third one was acquitted by jury in 1976. And then the fourth person indicted for the murders, Leonard Peltier, he was extradited from Canada and then eventually convicted and received two consecutive life sentences.
Leonard Peltier and the issues around his incarceration. You've been with this story your entire working life as a journalist. So, how did this affect you when you've been with the story for so long, Brian?
Well, at some point, and this is just me speaking as a professional journalist, you just detach yourself from the events and issues you cover and have very little part in resolving. I can't always get emotionally invested in the outcome. And there's always a story or two more to tackle off in the wings. I just have stacks of notes and folders of stories that I can't always make time for. But you keep tending to the stories that are important to your audience. And I know this has been a big profile case for decades, ever since his conviction and his sentencing. A lot of people in Indian country were very concerned because this talks to issues, justice issues for Indian country in general, equitable treatment. And that's been something that has been a concern of mine since I got chin deep into journalism back in the 1990s and will remain so for some time. It is something that I think wears you down after a while because the wheels of justice turn very slow. And you also have to make time to listen to all the voices, a lot of dissenting voices that come up in a situation like this. And so you talk to all the parties, you try to be as responsive to all the viewpoints that you get, and then you just wait because, again, as I said, I don't have a lot of hand in deciding what kind of, decisions get handed down from the powers that be, but you just kind of keep a beat on it and you keep your audiences informed of all the latest developments.
I feel like every time a president leaves office, the question always comes up. I feel like Leonard Peltier is like a perennial. Is he gonna? I mean, I even had that thought before President Biden left office. Like, I wonder if Leonard Peltier is if something's gonna happen. And then I thought, no, because nothing's happened for 50 years. And then my ears perked up, when I heard the newscast about the clemency.
Yeah. Now it's been a surprising turn of events. I was completely blindsided myself when I first heard the news. I thought perhaps maybe it was a hoax, fake news, something that had been instigated on social media perhaps. But when I saw the letter from President Biden, it was pretty clear that this was a commutation of his sentence. And again, this has been an effort that has been underway by Peltier supporters for decades. In fact, I think probably the most intensive ones have usually happened during Democratic presidencies. So Obama was very pressured into granting clemency or pardon. Clinton was also heavily pressured too back in 2000. And then there's also been pushback too, though. The FBI, for instance, I believe had a march that commemorated the memories of Agents Williams and Culler, with a number of agents, I believe 500, marching through Washington carrying their portraits, because they considered the act that took the agents' lives to be very cold-blooded and was done in execution style. So there's a lot of passion on both sides of this issue, and I think over time it became more about whether, less about whether or not Peltier was guilty of the murders or not, but more about how the trials had been handled. About there's been a lot of questions raised about how the trial was held and how witness testimony was provided. And so questions were raised about the justice system itself in handling this case. And then also, too, there's a lot of focus shifted to Peltier's declining health and his condition and the fact that he had spent
He's 80
already,
years old. Yeah, he's 80.
yes, 80 years old, reportedly suffering from an aortic aneurysm, I believe, was one of the diagnoses, and partial blindness, and I believe diabetes. So there's a number of things that people were calling attention to that they felt that at least this would be a humanitarian thing to commute his sentence and let him live out his final years with his community, with his family.
But Peltier was not granted a pardon. So what will clemency mean? You've already alluded to this. He'll be able it, this clemency will mean he'll be able to live out with his family. But it's not a pardon. There's a distinction.
No. Biden commuted his sentence, so it's not a pardon. It takes effect February 18th. So Peltier will spend the rest of his time in home confinement. The organization Indian Collective has bought him a house, they say, on the Turtle Mountain Indian Reservation in North Dakota, which is his original homeland. And it will be what it is. I think that there will be a lot of people in the law enforcement community and their supporters. I know that South Dakota Senator John Thune has expressed his dismay at this outcome, who will be opposed. But at the same time, there are a lot of other supporters, again, who say that he's spent well more than half his life behind bars. Let him live out his final years again with his family and with his community.
One of the interesting points about Leonard Peltier's advocates is that they're international. The Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, Pope Francis, and even the U.S. attorney who prosecuted Peltier, James Reynolds, wrote letters during his long incarceration advocating for commutation. What was it about Peltier's case that made it difficult for his advocates? And then conversely, what was it about Peltier's case that inspired such advocacy?
That's an excellent question, Anne. I think that there were a lot of people who came to see Peltier as a broader symbol of the injustice that the federal government has inflicted upon Native people since colonization, since westward expansion, and that the scales of justice have always been tilted against Native people in both small cases. I believe there's a lot of data that shows that BIPOC individuals tend to get pulled over and examined and investigated more so than the white population. I also think that given the violence and tensions on Pine Ridge and with the American Indian Movement through the 70s, that there was also a lot of concern for people who were outspoken advocates for sovereignty and equal justice and civil rights. And so I think over the years, Peltier has really grown as a symbol for Native people and for all people who are concerned about the rights of Indigenous communities worldwide. I think it's not a big surprise, actually, that people who are very concerned and attuned to world justice would want to come out and join the throngs who are behind Peltier. And so, yeah, when you consider that several Nobel Peace Prize laureates and the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa have all come out and called for his release or called for at least commutation, as we've seen in this past week, that is not surprising in many ways. I think, too, though, that there will always still be dissenters and there will always be people who felt that justice was served with Peltier behind bars. I'm thinking of the surviving relatives of the two slain agents. Peltier behind bars was a way to, for them and their perspective, to have justice and closure to the murders of their relatives.
Brian, thanks for spending this time with us, and I imagine we'll be following this closely because Leonard Peltier's coming home to North Dakota.
Yeah, no, that'll be something to see. And I'll be curious to see if anyone is granted access to him while he's out there. And, it'd be interesting to follow him around and see what it's like to have him back on Turtle Mountain and experiencing the comfort and atmosphere of a place that he's not seen for a long time.
journalist Brian Bull speaking with our director of radio, Anne Alquist, about President Biden granting Leonard Peltier clemency. Peltier has served almost 5 decades in prison for the murders of 2 FBI agents in a shootout at the Ogallala Sioux Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A 40-year-old law has protected millions of acres of wetlands on U.S. farm ground, but a company that owns land in Iowa says the law violates private property rights and is suing the USDA. As Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, the lawsuit could upend a major wetlands conservation policy.
At the Center for Agricultural Law and Taxation at Iowa State University, Director Christine Tidgren scrolls through the 1985 Farm Bill on her computer. She's looking for a section called Wetland Conservation.
So right in here is where it is.
Farmers, policymakers, and conservationists call this law Swamp Buster.
When Swamp Buster was enacted and put into law, there were concerns about preserving wetlands across the country.
By the mid-80s, over half of the original wetlands in the lower 48 states had been lost, largely through agricultural drainage. And people were worried. Wetlands provide vital habitat for wildlife, filter drinking water, and store floodwater. Tidgren says Swamp Buster aimed to protect what was left by linking conservation to federal benefits, like crop insurance and farm loans.
The idea was that if you did then convert those wetlands to farmland, then you would be denied a proportion of some of your farm benefits.
Today, farmers that drain, fill in, or alter designated wetlands on their land risk losing all farm subsidies. Swamp Buster has helped slow down the disappearance of wetlands in the U.S. But now, the long-standing law is being challenged in federal court. The case stems from 72 acres in northeastern Iowa owned by CTM Holdings, a company that rents out farmland. Jim Conlin is CTM's managing member.
It is very fertile, tillable soil, and it has spots in it that the government designated as wetland. And as a result, the trees can't be removed from it. It can't be used for anything, and they pay nothing for that.
When the USDA denied his request to reevaluate the wetland designation, Conlin, a retired Chicago attorney, says he started looking into Swamp Buster.
And the closer I read the statute, the more I said, this is crazy. This is clearly unconstitutional.
CTM's lawsuit argues that Congress did not have the authority to pass Swamp Buster and that it infringes on private property rights. Lauren C. Hayes with Liberty Justice Center is one of the attorneys for CTM.
Normally, when the government says, hey, I'm doing something for everybody, a public use, a public purpose, then it's a taking. They use the powers of eminent domain to take the property and they provide just compensation to the property owners.
But the USDA, along with a group of sustainable ag organizations intervening in the case, argue that Swamp Buster does not take or regulate land. It's part of congressional spending, which can come with conditions.
The thing that is very puzzling to me about plaintiff's argument is that they're basically arguing that farmers should be entitled to free taxpayer money with no strings attached.
That's Katie Garvey, a staff attorney with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, which is representing the Iowa Farmers Union in the case. Garvey says farmers who leave designated wetlands in place get access to subsidies worth billions of dollars.
The government's not taking anything from anybody. They're saying they have opened up a giant pot of money and they said, come and get it. Who wants it? Do you want it? Okay, here's the one thing you need to do in order to get it.
The lawsuit over wetland conservation is expected to go to trial this year. It comes on the heels of several U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have made it easier to challenge environmental laws and the federal agencies that carry them out. This includes the Sackett decision, which sharply limited the EPA's authority to regulate pollution released into wetlands and streams under the Clean Water Act. Michael Schmidt is an attorney with the Iowa Environmental Council, one of the organizations intervening in the Swamp Buster case.
Swamp Buster is one of the few conditions that we have in Iowa and nationwide addressing agricultural pollution and reducing agricultural pollution.
He says getting rid of the long-standing law would be a move in the wrong direction. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 21st. If you look at the ingredients in some foods, especially candy, you might spot blue number 2 on the list. While natural red dye comes from bugs, blue number 2 has a different origin. It was first extracted from coal, specifically lignite coal, which is commonly found in the western portion of North Dakota. In 1925, A.G. Leonard, the first state geologist of North Dakota, led the first statewide survey of the state's coal beds. He was assisted by geologists Leonard Dove and H.N. Eaton. Leonard announced their findings a year later, estimating that there were 516 billion tons of coal in the western part of the state. He acknowledged that this estimate was low since they didn't have access to the deeper deposits. In later years, the estimate grew to over 600 billion tons. Coal is typically associated with heating, but many other useful products come from it. On this date, in 1926, the Bismarck Tribune reported on a talk given by geologist Leonard Dove to the University of North Dakota Science Club. He shared that in 1919, he was given a pint of brownish-black gelatinous material to test. Dove discovered it came from lignite coal, and upon further investigation, found that it had dye properties valuable for commercial use. While he was correct, it's unlikely that Dove realized just how useful the compound would become. Methylene blue, as it is now known, has far more applications than Dove could have imagined. Still used as a dye, it is also valuable in the medical field, treating conditions like cyanide poisoning and septic shock. Additionally, it is used to test milk and water. The early geologists of North Dakota made significant strides in developing the state's natural resources. Deposits of oxidized lignite found in western North Dakota are now called Leonardite, named in honor of the state's first state geologist. While Leonard Dove's name isn't widely recognized, he deserves credit for understanding that lignite coal has many uses beyond heating. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful you spent time with us. Tomorrow, we'll check in with the Bismarck Downtowners with Rick Keon and Prairie Plates. Their second annual Burger Slam is underway. And that's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.